I'm John Batch with the author and historian David Petrucha. The book is 1920, the year of the six presidents. We've seen three of them so far. Teddy Roosevelt, who's gone in January of 1919. Woodrow Wilson, who's frail and will be for the rest of his life. He dies in 1924. And Warren G. Harding, who will not live out his first term. We turn now to the vice presidents of the moment, and one who is either a president or a vice president for both parties. We begin with FDR, a much different personality than we know him from his time in the White House. He was a Harvard graduate after 3 years. His family was, well, as David presents them, snootier than the rich families of New York State. Very snooty, very well connected. FDR was lucky enough to have a dominating mother who took care of him and his reputation the rest of his life. He met Eleanor Roosevelt in 1905, 1902, early in his life, and proposed to her, and they married. And so he is, and they have five children who survive. But when the period of time we're looking at, FDR is ambitious for more than he's won so far, which is a state senate seat from Dutchess County. And then as his older uncle, cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, he asks for the Wilson administration to make him Assistant Secretary of Navy. And because Josephus Daniels, the Secretary of the Navy from North Carolina, who likes white suits, is much away, Franklin Roosevelt, called Frank, he's not called FDR at this time, although we're going to refer to him as FDR to make a distinction with TR. Frank takes the reins and is a very active Assistant Secretary of Navy because he's ambitious for higher office. He imagines himself a president early on. Now we're in 1920, and Roosevelt's name is often mentioned as a possible outsider. But at this point, David, is this an outsider as vice president, or were they thinking a man at 38 could be the president?
Pretty much for vice president. I mean, he's not a contender. He's not going to get votes during the Democratic National Convention. There's a letter to the editor, I think, in the New York Times that says, why not him for president? But that's about as far as it goes. But, you know, obviously he, you know, if he's succeeded his cousin as a New York State legislator and then as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, well, why stop there? But he's not ready for prime time. He makes a lot of mistakes early in his career. He's comes damn close to being fired by Woodrow Wilson because he's undercutting Josephus Daniels, who is a very, very patient man, evidently. And he also makes mistakes on the campaign trail once he's nominated as vice president on the Democratic 1920 ticket, where he just is bragging. He's bragging and he makes stuff up. And when he's caught in it, he tries to lie his way out of it. So he's not quite ready at all for the presidency or the vice presidency, but that's going to change.
He's known as a playboy, and the playboy, again, this does not enter into campaigns, but it does enter into families, stems from the fact that living in Washington with Eleanor and the children, Eleanor hires an assistant, a young woman, Lucy Mercer, at 22 in 1914 to come in and help with a large family. Eventually, the Lucy Mercer FDR link up will last for the rest of FDR from Frank Roosevelt's life. In fact, Lucy's with him when he dies in Warm Springs. He has the stroke, the brain explodes. And Eleanor finds out about that during one of his trips in 1918 to the front, to France, and she finds letters. What is Eleanor's opinion of staying together? Because I know FDR's mother insists upon it.
Well, she's about ready to bolt at some point, but she does not. She sticks with him, but the marriage is really, boy, it's a, I mean, there is still something there, but it is more so a political partnership. I think one of her sons says, you know, we never saw them in the same room alone. And she was incredibly distant to him in many ways, including even the political aspect of their relationship. You see in 1928 and 1932, where she's quoted as saying, well, I don't care if he was elected governor. I don't care if he was elected president. I just don't care. You know, he can, you know, go off and lose, and I'll go on with my life, writing newspaper columns and making furniture up in the hills of Hyde Park or something. But it's a very, it's one of the more strained presidential marital relationships in history.
Alice Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, from his first wife, who dies when very young, said of Franklin Roosevelt, he deserves fun, knowing he's with Lucy Mercer, because he's married to Eleanor. So Eleanor was surrounded by harsh opinions in her life, and she gave some of them back, some of them ironic. The Calvin Coolidge marriage is 179 degrees from this. Is that what we could describe, David?
Yes. I mean, there's no infidelity on Cal's part. And he's, despite being, shall we say, having a reputation as a tightwad, he's known to spend very much on his wife's wardrobe, going window shopping in the streets of Washington, D.C., and pointing stuff out and saying, send that to the White House and see how she'll like it. Grace Coolidge is, however, the antipode, the opposite of Eleanor Roosevelt, in that she doesn't say much about, you know, politics, if anything, ever. You're starting to see a bunch of newsreels, sound newsreels, coming out now on the internet. And boy, she was actually a very good looking woman, one of the better looking first ladies. I mean, people were just stunned that Cal Coolidge could attract such a good looking, charming, effervescent woman. And you see these in these early sound newsreels. If they had unleashed her on the public in modern media at that point, she would have been much better remembered than she is now.
As much as I've read about Cal Coolidge, and again, David takes us into the high points and entertaining points of Cal Coolidge in action now, emerging as governor of Massachusetts, very attractive to the Republican Party, because of his stances on the strikes of the police, and because he's matter of fact when he makes decision making. What strikes me about him is that he's still a mystery to me, David. What was going on? His speeches sound like he's arranged them to keep us out of his thinking. He's a man from Vermont, Plymouth Notch, Vermont, which you say when it snows, it's an island in the world. And he often goes back to Plymouth Notch to touch base. What about living in the mountains of Vermont describes his personality?
It really is. It's a beautiful spot, but it is very, very remote even to this day. And when he gets the word in 1923 that Warren Harding has died, there's only one telephone in the entire hamlet. I wouldn't call it a village. His father is, though, the big man in the hamlet, and is quite admired. Almost worshipped by his son Cal as a fellow who can do everything and is righteous in a good way. Upstanding, I think, is probably the better word. I think that is what creates the Coolidge persona or boom, shall we speak, in the 1920s, that he's not a glad hander. He'll do what he says he's going to do and not promise anything more. But when he says something, you can count on it. And that's very important when, after Warren Harding dies, and you get all these scandals, and, you know, the Republican Party could have imploded at that point. But Coolidge springs into action and cleans it up, or just lets the process clean it up and gets out of the way. And say, and so the public says, we can trust this guy.
FDR is born 1882. Coolidge is born 1872, so he's 10 years older. One more. Herbert Hoover, born in Iowa, Quaker, poor family that breaks up, and Hoover goes to work right away. This is a man called the great engineer who is relentless in his life and nothing but good works all his life. His reputation today has nothing to do with the facts of his biography. He wins an opportunity to go to Stanford because it's tuition free. A relative takes care of the expenses for he and his brother. He eventually will marry Lou Henry, whom he meets at Stanford. He goes to work in the mines for 12 hours a day and rises to be a clerk because he's a college graduate, and eventually becomes a millionaire, travels all around the world, including in China during the Boxer Rebellion. He's brave, he's relentless, he's successful during the First War. He's in Europe at the time of the outbreak, and he helps get the Americans home, who are frightened, and to traverse the Atlantic with the submarine warfare underway. And then he feeds all of Europe. The number was quite fantastic, 300 million Europeans because of Hoover's programs. And yet, here we are in 1920. Both parties are looking at Hoover as, is this a president? And I got the understanding, David, that he could, that either party would have been happy to have him as a nominee. And he himself kept saying, I'm probably a Republican, but nobody believed him. He was neither.
Well, he had among his other accomplishments up to this point was he was the American food czar during World War One, which is a job which could have made enemies all around. He did make some enemies in the farm block, so to speak, but generally, I mean, his popularity skyrocketed in a very tense position, and that meant in doing that, that he was a member of Woodrow Wilson's administration. He goes with Woodrow Wilson to Versailles, to Europe, and he's a big booster of Wilson. He also had been not a stand pat Republican, not a Taft Republican. He had been for TR in 1912. So where is he on the ideological political spectrum? Democrat with Wilson, born a Republican, a progressive like TR. And yes, he wins two primaries in the 1920 season in New Hampshire and in Michigan, and they're Democratic primaries. And somebody says, you know, he'd be a great, among other people who say he'd be a great president and could maybe salvage things for the Democratic Party, is Franklin D. Roosevelt. And Franklin D. Roosevelt authorizes a friend to go to Herbert Hoover and to propose to him a Herbert Hoover, Franklin Delano Roosevelt presidential ticket. Imagine that, sports fans.
It's imaginable. From what we know today, of course, the two will meet tragically in 1933 for the inauguration. That picture of them sitting in the limousine as they go to the inauguration, David.
A bit grim.
It's very difficult, but that was the future. We're in 1920. And so what we have are three potential candidates for the vice presidency here. We know that each of them will be chosen, but we need to go to the conventions because nothing is predictable about conventions in 1920. Unlike today, where everything is decided months beforehand, taking all the drama out. There's nothing but drama, exhaustion, and remember, the country's under prohibition. David Petrucha, the book is 1920, the year of the six presidents. Next, it'll be June. We'll be in Chicago with the Republicans.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.